46. The classified ad caught his eye. A mint green 1967 Chevy Impala. As is, some work needed. He called the owner and they talked for a few minutes. The man gave Eli an address in Kittery and said he could stop by that evening. Eli borrowed his mother's car and went to check it out.
Had a couple calls about it, said the owner, who introduced himself as Bear.
His heavy frame spoke of youthful muscles gone soft after years of being bathed in beer.
Mostly college kids. They want to know if they can get it painted black like that Supernatural car.
Eli didn't understand the reference. The only two Supernatural cars he could think of were a red 58 Plymouth Fury and a customized 71 Lincoln Continental Mark III. Nobody would ever mistake a 67 Impala for either of them. Bear took him over to the garage, walked past it, and pulled a tarp off the vehicle there. As Eli had suspected, the Impala was mountain green, not mint. The paint was faded in places, worn away down to metal in others. Rust coated the undercarriage. Salt corrosion had eaten a few tiny holes in the floorboards and one the size of a half dollar behind the driver's seat. All four tires were smoother than an old pair of sneakers. It had been a long time since the car had a roof over its head. Not the best thing in New England. The engine looked good, though, and the battery was new. Bear repeated the Impala's need for some work, then asked for a large sum.
It being a classic and all.
Eli countered with two-thirds as much, pointing out how much repairs would cost. They batted prices back and forth for a few minutes before settling on an amount Eli said he could pay in cash. He caught a ride from Corey the next day and drove home with his new car. He stopped for new tires first. Second, a general tune-up of the engine, transmission, brakes, and alignment. New headlights as well. Saturday, when he had the car inspected, he slipped the mechanic an extra 50. The woman set a few metal plates along the Impala's floor to cover the holes and deemed the car roadworthy. He didn't bother to touch up the weather-beaten green paint, automotive camouflage. People rarely broke into a car that looked like crap. The night after he screwed his own license plates on the Impala, he took his mother out to dinner and told her his plans. More or less. The following night, he met up with his friends at the bar in Dover, bought them a few rounds of drinks and nachos, and explained what he was doing. Josh shook his head and laughed. Robin smiled and looked at the Derby. Corey nodded approvingly. The following morning, 2 months, 2 weeks, and 2 days after his return, Eli Teague kissed his mother goodbye, climbed into his beat-up Impala, and left Sanders. He took the southern route, driving down Interstate 95 and eventually cutting across 85 to 40 west. The Impala's radio didn't work, and while that would have driven him nuts at one point in his life, he found the sounds of the road soothing enough. When he got tired, he pulled into rest stop parking lots and slept in his car, with his Derby tipped down over his eyes. He changed clothes twice in the passenger seat, ate most of his meals behind the wheel. As he passed through Memphis, he considered diverting south to New Orleans. He wondered how it had changed in the 160 years since he'd last been there. The exit for southbound 55 came and went. He didn't look back. Eli drove through Amarillo, Albuquerque, and Flagstaff before entering California. He allowed himself one detour and took the Impala down through Los Angeles to cut back and drive up the coast. The Pacific Ocean was beautiful, but as a lifelong New Englander, he couldn't shake the surreal feeling that the water stretched out the wrong way, especially when the sun went down. He spent a night in a San Luis Obispo hotel, where he took a long shower and slept until the maid woke him up the next morning. He ate a late breakfast at a diner near the beach, filled up the Impala's gas tank, and got back on the road. Noon passed before he reached Sacramento. He drove through and continued northeast, into the mountains. He reached over and dragged the legal pad off the passenger seat. A few glances confirmed the directions he'd spent hours searching for online and in library books. He reached the small ranger's station a little after 4 o'clock, but the park ranger had already left. Eli glanced through the window at the one-room office and wondered how often he or she came by to check on things. A gate stretched across the dirt road, chained at the middle, so Eli drove the Impala around the building and back onto the southbound road. He passed a few weathered, charred beams reaching up from the ground. A wooden sign stood near them. He guessed it described the site as the remains of a barn. Another 3 minutes of driving brought him to Hourglass. Half the buildings had vanished altogether. Half of what remained had become wooden skeletons. According to the few snippets of history he'd been able to find, the first time around had caught fire on May 31st, 1886, killing 9 people as it burned to the ground. The chandeliers had been a huge fire hazard after all. The bank had closed in July, taking the post office, the sheriff's station, the second iteration, and most of the citizens with it. The remaining families and businesses struggled on for a few months, but, as Harry had said, the town had been abandoned before the end of the year. He killed the Impala's engine, left the keys in the ignition. The sun hung above the horizon, but the air had cooled already. He punched his derby down on his head and slung his coat over his shoulder. It took him a few moments to orient himself, even though he'd been there just 3 months ago. The few black-tipped stubs to his left were the remains of the first time around. The bank's foundation still looked solid, as did two of the walls. A few steps past the bank gave him a view of the second iteration's stripped and sun-bleached husk. The wooden sidewalk's frame still stood, but all its planks had long since vanished. Eli wandered down Main Street toward the vast plain where hundreds of cars had parked for one brief week over a century ago. He counted foundations where the houses had been stripped away by nature or scavengers. He reached the next intersection and smiled. Somehow, in the odd way of such things, the last paradox remained mostly whole. Only a dozen or so shingles sat up on the roof. The front railing had split at some point. One of the swinging doors had been claimed by history, but its twin still hung by rusted hinges. While the left-hand window had broken and been cleaned away at some point, the right-hand one sat with just a single crack to show the passage of time. The painted snake, its tail clutched in its mouth, had barely faded or flaked at all. He stared at the old saloon for almost 10 minutes. Eli reached out and set a hand on the dry railing. "I suppose it's my last visit," he said to nobody in particular. He went inside. Much like the outside, the interior of the last paradox had fared better than most. It was the ghost town saloon the television had prepared him for. 3 tables still stood, and twice as many chairs, but many of their brothers and sisters still lay where they'd fallen. A spiderweb of cracks stretched across the bar's mirror, and a few squares and triangles of glass had fallen free. He counted half a dozen bottles still shelved behind the bar. Dusty cobwebs draped the rafters and the metal loop that would have passed for a chandelier. He'd heard of spots like this, which had somehow escaped the worst of history and humanity. Abandoned for decades, but never looted or repurposed. Shelves still stocked, wood piles intact, coal buckets full. A pot sat on the battered stove in the corner. Plates, glasses, and bottles were scattered on the tables. He went back outside and walked the rest of Main Street. The road had been picked and kicked clean over the years. Old tire tracks from park vehicles decorated most of it. No nails or broken glass or other immediate hazards. Eli lined up the Impala. The engine rumbled between the old buildings. He watched the road for a ripple, a swirl in the dust, anything that stood out. The air sparkled, and he hit the gas. The Impala roared down Main Street and through a patch of sunlit dust. Eli muttered, took the car down to the edge of town, and turned around. He crawled back into Hourglass, his eyes glued to the road. A faint shimmer danced in the air, and the muscle car leaped forward again. The new tires gripped the dirt every inch of the way, never losing traction for a second as he blasted through the heat haze. He sighed and circled around at the big intersection, swerving past the remains of the first time around and the bank. The third time he drove the Impala at what turned out to be a swarm of gnats as they looped and spun and twisted across the road. The fourth time was another patch of dust. The fifth time, the setting sun hit a smear of gnat juice on the windshield and created a glow. Eli brought the Impala around again. He was running out of sunlight. 4, maybe 5 more runs, unless he wanted to keep trying in the dark. Something in the corner of his eye caught his attention. He slapped his foot down on the brakes. A heartbeat later, he killed the engine. Harry sat on the steps outside the last Paradox. Her frock coat sprawled open to show off a red vest and a baggy shirt, while her tricorn balanced on one knee. A brown bag sat next to her, along with a small drift of what looked like peanut shells. Her lips were pressed tightly together, but the corners of her mouth and eyes fluttered.
"Harry?"
"Please," she said, waving him on. "Don't mind me, just continue making an ass of yourself."
She shook 2 nuts out of the shell and pushed them into her mouth, stifling a laugh. Eli got out of the Impala, dragging his coat after him, and walked over to her.
"How long have you been sitting there? How long have I been sitting here watching you drive up and down the road like a fool? Long enough that you'll be regretting it for some time to come."
She pulled another peanut from the bag and tore it open. Then she giggled and dropped it back in the bag.
"I waited for weeks and you didn't show up."
"Well, I've been looking for you for months,"
she said, pushing herself up off the steps.
"I showed up in Sanders and everyone told me about how you'd bought a car and driven off into the sunset.
Once I realized I was going in and out of town with no problem, I figured it was safe for me to leave and come looking for you."
He crossed his arms.
"Besides, how can you be late when you can travel through history?"
"Not there,"
she said.
"Not anymore. The closest slick spot to Sanders is down in Boston now, and it's almost a year off."
"That far?"
She nodded.
"The best I could find was about 4 months after they let you go. Almost a third of them are gone. James thinks there may be a dozen or so new ones, but nobody's quite figured out where they are. And Eleanor was a wreck. I worked on her for a month, and that was with John's help."
They stood there for a moment. Harry knocked some dust from her tricorn. She examined the hat to make sure she hadn't missed any spots.
"So,"
said Eli. He looked past her to the tavern.
"We made it to the last Paradox."
"We did,"
said Harry. She pushed the hat up onto her head.
"Thanks to you."
"I just got lucky. Put a few things together. You did all the work."
"We did it together then."
"Yeah."
They looked at each other.
"So,"
he said.
"Now what? There's no search? No dream to be had? What do we do now?"
Harry's lips formed a soft, nervous smile.
"There's always a dream to be had."
"Yeah?"
"Yes."
He felt his own lips pull into the same awkward smile and felt a sudden need to check his boots for dust or dirt. Harry cleared her throat.
"As I see it, there are 2 options in our immediate future."
"Okay."
"One,"
she said, jerking her thumb behind her,
"is there's a celebration going on here back in 1886.
"Right here?"
She nodded.
"Everyone who made it. About 3 dozen of us. James is there. John's there chatting with Monica. Did you meet her?
Dark hair, wears a business suit."
"That's her. Danny Cooper's with her. Alice Ramsey's come back for the end, and she's so old now. Maisie Wang was just heading in when I left."
"When you left?"
"I had to go looking for my partner,"
she said.
"Who I might note is not smart enough to just stay at home where I can find him."
"Sorry."
"You should be. Dumb luck I found you here."
"I think I found you."
"Don't nitpick Mr. Teague."
She overemphasized his name.
"So, option one is a party."
Harry nodded.
"And they're all waiting for you."
"Me?"
"Us, technically. We are the ones who found the dream."
"Ah. What's option 2?
She looked at her own boots.
"I've been driving around America for a while now. I was thinking it was time to try somewhere new. Maybe Canada or Cuba."
"There aren't any roads to Cuba." Harry looked up at him.
"Not yet,"
she said.
"But I happen to know a shortcut, if you don't feel like waiting."
She blinked twice and met his gaze again.
"Well,"
said Eli, "is there any reason we can't do both?"
"None at all."
She reached out, then pulled her hands back.
"Eleanor's just around the corner. Do you have everything?"
Eli looked down at the coat, hooked on his fingers. He felt the brim of his hat against his head. He glanced back at the Impala and imagined a park ranger finding the muscle car in the center of town in a few days, still with half a tank of gas and the keys in the ignition.
"Yeah,"
he said.
"I've got everything I need."
The corners of her mouth twitched, and her lips stretched a little wider across her face. She leaned forward, brought her face close to his, and then settled back on her heels.
Okay, then. Let's go.
They stepped off the stairs of the last paradox together.
Oh, she added. One thing.
Yeah?
If this is going to be a permanent arrangement, I'm going to need you to chip in for fuel.
I'm sure we'll work out something, Eli said.
I'm sure we will.